It is a physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today. Talk about a lot of things as usual, physical therapy issues, but we're going to focus to begin the show a little bit on prehabilitation. That's getting yourself ready for major medical procedures. And our two experts are back with us, Jill Tine Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here. Good morning.
And good to have back Lori Tine Brody, who is a physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Laura, good to see you as well.
Great to be here on a lovely spring day.
All right. I guess it is. What questions do you have for our two guests as we move along? We'll take all your PT questions. If you've got some prehabilitation questions, we'd love to hear those as well. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You know, we've talked, we're usually talking about the rehabilitation, the post, and we have also mentioned several times over the years, but I don't know that we've ever sort of gone into a lot of detail on it.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So this, Jill and I brought a paper that looked at 21 meta-analyses. So those are research studies that pool together a number of different studies. So sometimes the sample size is too low in an individual study to be able to say anything about it. So a meta-analysis will pool together a bunch of those papers and try to draw a more significant conclusion. So they really looked at over 4,000 patients, 1,000 of which had total hip replacements, and over 3,000 who had total knee replacements. And they tried to suss out the impact of going to prehabilitation, and that is going and doing some rehab prior to getting your surgery. Does it make a difference in your outcomes? Is your pain less? Is your length of stay shorter? Does your function and range of motion return sooner? And, you know, the big picture conclusion was that, yes, some prehabilitation does improve outcomes, particularly in objective and subjective outcomes, such as complication rates reduced, increased range of motion, increased strength. That being said, despite all the research in these 21 meta-analyses, there's still many things that we don't know. So these people who came in for prehabilitation came in generally three times a week for anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks. We really don't know if this prehabilitation was supervised by a physical therapist or if they were just instructed in this program and the patients reported that they did these exercises. The control groups against which these prehabilitation patients were compared either had what they called usual care or education. So again, we have no idea.
No idea
what usual care is, and education. That education may involve like riding a bike, going for a walk, doing these exercises. We have no idea what those people did. So, you know, the comparison is not great.
And they did see some differences.
But they did see differences. And in fact, the differences were most profound in the research papers that had the largest sample sizes. So the research that had small samples generally didn't show an effect. So, you know, that washes out some of the effects of the larger sample size when you pool it all together.
So is the I'm interested in understanding the differences, the potential differences between what do you do beforehand in terms of getting ready versus what are you having people do afterwards? Is there a big difference, Jill?
Well, first of all, I'd say any intervention you do on a patient with degenerative changes could be considered prehab. So the million-dollar question is when you see that patient in front of you that's got you know, degenerative changes in their knee, and you start them on a rehabilitation program, you identify all their impairments, their weakness, their lack of range of motion, maybe impaired cardiovascular activity, and you design a program for them that's going to better all those impairments. What's the difference between that and prehab? Isn't everything kind of, it could be prehab. So I always tell my students that you're starting your patient on this care program. It could be rehab, and it could be that now the patient doesn't need surgery, or it's prehab and you're getting them ready for surgery. And in my mind, those programs look essentially the same until you get closer to the time of surgery where you really want to make sure you don't do anything to flare up the joint.
So you taper it off.
You taper it off a little bit. Yeah, you don't try new things. Hey, you're having surgery in 2 weeks. Let's try some new activities. No, you don't do that. But in my mind, rehab and prehab look pretty much the same. You're going to address the patient's impairments. Now, post-surgery and pre-surgery,
you start slow.
You're going to start slow, and you're going to still address their impairments, but their impairments may look different, especially if you think about a patient who's had a total knee. Perhaps prior to surgery, they had pretty good knee range of motion, and now when they get these new components in, they have to learn how to bend and straighten all over. So you may be spending more time post-operatively working on range of motion than you did before surgery, just depending on your patient's impairments. Again, that's why it's important to see a physical therapist and determine what needs to be customized for you. And that's the other thing we don't know about this paper, Lori, if all these little programs that they were doing was a one-size-fits-all or if they were individualized.
Yeah. Right,
so that's another fault in this paper.
Yeah, and I would use the term fault
loosely.
I mean, we do the best we can. It's a limitation.
It's a limitation.
It's a limitation in interpreting the results. Mm-hmm. So, and that's really what we see in most physical therapy research. But, you know, in terms of post, as you suggested, you have that big inflammatory reaction.
Right.
You've got a hot, uncomfortable, swollen, painful joint. So what you're doing immediately post-op is very different from what you're doing immediately pre-op, because we want it really calm, just as you said, prior to surgery. The last thing you want is a hot joint going into surgery. That's a recipe for disaster.
What is the difference between how you feel after, let's say, a knee replacement versus a hip replacement?
Oh, all those patients out there who are listening who have had a knee replacement
are rolling their eyes
and moaning, yeah, because the general consensus is after you come out of a hip replacement, you feel great.
Right.
Like you feel so, thank goodness I feel a lot better after a knee replacement. That is a rough rehabilitation.
Why did I ever do this?
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Well, and I would say anecdotally, I think there's a little honeymoon phase in the post-total knee surgery where those arthritic changes that people had and all that arthritis, that's all gone. So they have this beautiful congruent joint. And I would say sometimes the first 2 or 3 weeks is kind of the honeymoon phase. And then reality sets in where, oh my gosh, I really need to start working on my range of motion more, or stiffness is going to set in. And oh, I feel so good. I'm getting up on this knee a lot more and I'm standing a lot more. And all of a sudden I end up with all this swelling. So anecdotally, I would say it's not uncommon for somebody to have maybe their first 10 days post knee to not feel awful. But as you said, they're not doing a lot of demand on it. They're babying it. And then once you start like, okay, we got to start loading, you got to start walking, you got to start bending, then people are like, holy smokes, why did I do this? I'm questioning my judgment.
One of the hardest things after a knee replacement is getting their knee bending range of motion. We really want you to 120, 125 degrees. Some of those patients didn't have that going into surgery. So it's rough getting it afterwards, especially when that knee hurts in that couple weeks afterwards. But it's really important that you get that range within the first 12 weeks. Because after that, dense connective tissue is really hard to change.
And you think about the huge incision that patients have over the front of their knee.
Yeah.
And so you're trying to bend and you're pulling on this incision, and patients feel like their staples are going to blow open or their sutures are going to blow open. And it's a lot. It is a lot.
couple of other points. One, I wonder, is there anything in relation to diet when it comes to prehabilitation? Or is it, I mean, it's the prehabilitation mm-hmm. sounds like it's only going to be for 3 weeks mm-hmm. or something.
Four to six weeks in
four
the,
to
in
six,
this research.
So diet's not going to have much of a factor there.
Probably not. Diet is a much more long-term, has an impact, but it does have an impact, and it is important.
And from an inflammatory mm-hmm. perspective, yes, for sure.
And psychologically, is there anything other than just describing how they're going to feel afterwards? And
Some of it is related to how you do afterwards. So your pain levels, your strength, your function. Can I get in and out of a chair? Can I sleep in my bed? Am I getting a decent night's sleep? How quickly am I able to be independent in my home? And those things definitely impact your psychological health.
Right. The more you feel independent, as mm-hmm. Lori alluded to, the better you are. Now, having said that, there's always that line of what you could be doing, what you should be doing. You know, there are people who do too much too soon, too fast, and then they end up with all the swelling. So mm-hmm. it's this delicate balance of finding things that you can be successful at while respecting kind of the inflammatory process and everything that new joint is telling you.
And things like if my house, my bedroom's mm-hmm. on the second floor.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
A hospital bed on the first floor for short term might be something. And again, most of these are elective surgeries. So hopefully those things have been discussed and there's a plan and care in mm-hmm. place to kind of address those things. But there are people who will do a short term rental on a hospital bed on the first floor so they don't have to navigate stairs for a couple of weeks.
And it can be difficult for people who live alone.
Right.
Especially if it is a right hip or a right knee because they can't drive.
Right.
Oh.
Correct.
Oh.
Yep, correct.
So it's
relying
on friends or
correct.
Uber.
Correct. Yep. And getting to therapy mm-hmm. and all of those things. So it is important. I think, Larry, you bring up a really good point of the surgery is elective for most people. And so to have all those stakeholders in place is mm-hmm. really important.
Our guests today, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, they come by every month to talk about physical therapy issues, and you can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues today with our two experts, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the UW-Madison. It's great to have them back, and they come by every month about this time of the month, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact, to talk with us. Elizabeth in Poinette emailed to say she could attest to the benefits of preparing for surgery with a fitness program. Elizabeth took a UW Health Strength and Stability class for 2 years prior to right total knee replacement surgery in June of 2024, their post-op physical therapists were so impressed with their rehab, they were always assessed at above average ability to perform exercises. And she's convinced that the preparation helped their recovery, said they resumed, she resumed her strength classes a few weeks later.
So that's a really good example of, I wouldn't even call that mm-hmm. rehab, I call that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is Elizabeth, sounds like she's very dedicated to her overall health, her fitness. It's a lifestyle for her. And so her drop in her function with that total knee was smaller than somebody who was kind of digging out of a hole per se.
Mm-hmm.
Christina in Glenwood City will go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm a 67-year-old. I weigh about 100 pounds. On February 18th, I was full out running through a dog agility course with my athletic 46-pound dog. He slammed into me on the left side, sending me flying through the air. I landed full out on my right side, and I didn't think anything of it, but then I started having some issues, and now I have a problem. Every day I wake up, my neck on the left side is very, very stiff. My arms, I have difficulty raising them up and my hands are so inflamed I could barely move them. And I use a home sauna. I do Epsom salt soap. I'm seeing a physical therapist, and right now we're doing gentle isometrics. I went to a sports medicine doctor. He put me on prednisone for 5 days. On the fifth day, I noticed relief, so I'm thinking it's inflammatory, and I'm considering cryotherapy. What are your thoughts?
So when you're talking about gentle isometrics, is this at your cervical spine, at your neck, Christina? Where are we doing isos at?
Well, yeah, it's on the left side of my neck, and then so I'm doing some gentle neck exercises, arm and hand exercise.
Okay, yeah. It sounds to me like almost a whiplash. Mm-hmm. So you think about a dog that weighs half of your weight, you know, jettisoning you across something and landing, and the whiplash. So you landed on your right side. So, you know, she probably had a huge frontal plane.
An eccentric of her, the left side of her neck.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you getting numbness or tingling or anything like that? Have they screened you for disc herniations?
They haven't really screened. They did an x-ray, and, you know, one doctor suggested rheumatoid arthritis.
Oh, good grief.
Another one said, maybe it's just mild arthritis. So I haven't really had that level of evaluation yet.
Okay. Well, if you're not having neurologic symptoms,
right,
I would probably stick with the sort of whiplash response and a lot of soft tissue and connective tissue injury to this, and then continuing with the physical therapist, maybe some dry needling if you're having some trigger points in that connective tissue, the soft tissue, but isometrics and range of motion are where you would typically start with this.
And I would make sure that you're getting a lot of like good neuromuscular re-education, because this is about 2 months old. So then my question is, has she also developed really faulty movement patterns with your head and neck and things like that? So there might be a little bit more to correct with that. So just, I think, being mindful of how you move, maybe using a mirror would be helpful too. But yeah, I think you should, with this intervention, start turning the corner, I would think, wouldn't you, Lori?
Yeah, I would too. Yeah. But it could be longer than, it could take longer than you might expect.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Don't give up. Christina, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Ann in Duluth, Minnesota next. Hi, Ann.
Hi. About 8 or 9 years ago, I was having problems with my left knee. It was very sore, and there were times I could barely walk. So I went to an orthopedic doctor who said within 5 years I'd have to have surgery, and I thought, just for that. So I worked on it, and it's been really good. But about 2 weeks ago, I climbed a high tower. Then I sat on an airplane for 5 hours, and the next day it was super sore and very stiff. And then, of course, this weekend, when I thought it was getting better, I climbed up a rocky hill, tripped on a rock, and slammed into a rock.
Oh.
So I guess my question is, should I be babying this, or should I keep up my regular routine but just try to take it easy, or what?
Such great questions.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
That's exactly what you should do. You know, it's a continuum. It's not, do I do this, yes, or do I not do it, no. It is listening to your knee and babying it to some extent. Like, you want to back things down because you don't want to aggravate it. It's already unhappy. So you have to figure out what's the right dosage of activity that you and your knee can agree upon together. Because you're not going to win the battle by forcing your knee to do things it can't do right now because you have re-injured it. But you should recover from this.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Lori likes the word homeostasis. Yeah. So you've stirred the pot a little bit. You did some things to your knee that it was unexpected and surprised. Oh, wait, we're going to climb this and then we're going to sit for 5 hours. That's new to us. We haven't done that. So it's a little angry. But like Lori said, you just need to listen to it and respond appropriately. I give you props for the fact that you have avoided a total knee replacement by doing all this. So if you hadn't done all those things that you've done previously, Anne, your recovery from these things would be much, much longer.
Yeah.
So I know it feels like you've had these little setbacks. They are minor compared to where you would be if you hadn't taken control of your knee 8 to 9 years ago. So props to you.
Good for you, Anne. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. You can trade in two numbers, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Let's turn to Dennis, who's south of Eau Claire. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to chime in that back in August and then October of 2021, I had both my knees replaced. And prior to that, I started physical therapy to get things ready. That was recommended to me, and a physical therapist did a great job and worked on both knees. And then after the first surgery, while they were trying to get the right knee able to bend like it should and all of that, they kept working on the left one to prep it. And the first week is hell.
Yes, it is.
But you know, but I made it through it. I'm here, and it just got better. And the physical therapy was the biggest thing in my recovery and my ability to get back.
Yeah.
So, Dennis, did you do a lot of those things at home on your own, or did you go into the clinic for that prior to your surgery?
Prior to the surgery, I went into the clinic, and the physical therapist did some stuff with me and then gave me a set of exercises to do.
Mm-hmm. Great. Would you say you're better now than you were prior to surgery? You had two total knees relatively close together. Mm-hmm. So you're about 3.5 years out of those. Are you a happy,
right.
Are you a happy camper?
Well, it's, I'm not like I'm 30 again.
Well, I'm pretty sure they probably didn't promise that with surgery.
Exactly.
If they did, everyone would be lined up.
Yeah. But it sounds like you're in good shape, as good as could be expected,
right,
given age and everything else, Dennis. Thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Appreciate it very
appreciate
much.
Appreciate that experience,
yeah,
sharing that with us.
Yeah.
Kathy in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about my son. He is 44 and has always been trim and athletic and quick. What happened is he injured something, or something showed up in his left hip, and it had to be scraped inside there. So he does not have a lot of arthritis, and they said they did the operation 2 weeks ago, arthroscopic, so no big cuts. But he has tremendous pain, and he stays in his apartment. He doesn't go, he hasn't gone out much for this entire 2 weeks. But now he had to return to work today. And we were already seeing so much pain just staying home, staying in his apartment and not doing stairs much. So what we observed every day for a week, we were with him, helping him. My husband stayed there longer beforehand. And he would change his position often, go from sitting here or sitting there, or walking or standing. Now, after the 2 weeks, I did see him standing once in a while briefly without the crutch, but I think he mostly needs at least one just to make sure he doesn't lose his balance. But he is a young man with great balance. But it's this pain thing, and the pain medicine, of course, means he's not supposed to drive,
mm-hmm,
with that, but now,
yeah,
he's supposed to be going back to work. So I don't know how that's going to go. My husband is considering going back to help him some more.
Has he, Kathy, started therapy yet? Did he have femoral acetabular impingement? Do you know when you talked about the scraping, I'm curious to what that was.
Yes, he did use the word impingement.
Okay.
So he used the word labrum tear.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yep.
Yeah, femoral plasty with a labral tear. Sure.
Yep.
So has he started therapy yet?
Not yet. He's seeing his doctor now for the first time after the surgery. He sees the doctor later this week.
Okay. He should definitely be starting therapy then, and I think that will actually make him feel better,
mm-hmm,
because the problem is I think things are probably getting a little stiff in there,
mm-hmm,
and so starting therapy will actually make him feel better.
Right.
So make sure that, you know, you have those appointments set up so you don't have to wait a couple weeks went to see the physician to take a couple more weeks to get into therapy. But I think that will help tremendously.
Right. Yeah. The therapy is really important. Yeah. After the surgery, I have a son who had this done on both hips.
Yes, you do.
And so, of course, being who I am, you know, we made sure he got going on his therapy right away.
Right.
And it is uncomfortable.
Right away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes. So, you know, being in my house, so we'd spent a lot of time icing for the first couple of weeks and then tried to get him up, and he was using crutches and he was partial weight bearing, but trying to keep him active and moving, not letting him sit around and play video games all day,
which is what he wanted to
which
do,
is what he wanted
he was a
to
teenage
do.
Boy
but getting them moving, so absolutely make sure he insists on getting into therapy and getting that going.
Yeah, he'll feel a lot better.
Yeah.
Good luck, Kathy. Thank you for calling. Gwen in Weyerhaeuser, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I have a question about total knee replacements. Is it my correct understanding that a muscle-sparing or quad-sparing procedure is different than a traditional replacement procedure?
They don't take down the quadriceps. It might be a ligament-sparing. Is that what you're thinking of? Because there's different versions depending upon whether or not your cruciate ligament is intact. So there's a cruciate sparing, and then another model that is used when your cruciates are absent. But I've never heard of a quadriceps.
Mm-mm.
No.
Mm-mm.
Quadriceps function is critical to your knee function. So they wouldn't be taking your quadriceps.
No.
No.
Does that make sense to you, or?
Makes absolute sense to me.
Okay, good, yeah. Yeah, because your quads will be very important.
Yeah,
And they'll actually, I don't know if it was, if by sparing they meant something with the patella. Typically you get a little piece on the undersurface of your patella that matches the components they put in.
Yeah,
so.
But the sparing piece to me, that probably has to do with the ligaments, and that's really depends upon the status of your cruciate ligaments. So if you don't have cruciates, you got to have components that accommodate that, right?
Yep. There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gwen. Appreciate it. Lee in Sauk County. On to you now. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I'm a former college athlete, and I had injured my hip back in college from a running incident. And since college, I've been able to keep my hip pretty happy through, you know, physical therapy, chiropractic care, massage therapy, all those things. But at the end of 2023, I gave birth, and ever since then, this hip injury has just resurfaced and has been kind of a menace. I've had three MRIs done and found that potentially I have sacroiliitis in my SI joint. That's where the pain mostly is. I get that kind of like pinching feeling above my my buttock, and then it kind of rainbows all the way to my IT band, and it's trying to find the right motion to do where it doesn't get too irritated. I'm now seeing my second physical therapist for it, because just the first one I saw, I mean, she was great, but I felt like a lot of the exercises were actually causing me pain. They were just irritating my hip. And so I'm seeing another one. We're doing a lot of exercises that don't involve weight. I've done dry needling. I don't know. I'm feeling I'm still pretty young. And so it's just kind of hard to have this pain. And I was just wondering if you had any other recommendations.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes. First question is, what was your sport as a college athlete?
Cross country and track. I was doing like K repeats in a field, and my left leg fell into a hole, and my like left hip like shifted to the point where like I was pinching, like I had so much bad pinching on my left side, I was like dragging my leg, and then through chiropractic care and PT, I finally got it to calm down. So that was the initial injury.
Okay.
So I'm curious why you had three MRIs. So I understand, were they at different parts? Did they do a pelvic MRI and a hip MRI and a spine MRI? Or what was the deal with having three? And then my next question is, are you hypermobile?
Right. That was
and
that
then
was
my next question
there.
Is, and then my next question would be, are you seeing a
pelvic
floor
therapist?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we're on the same page.
Okay.
Yep, so the outer, I had one just on my back to make sure that was okay. The one was on my outer hip to see if they thought maybe I had a labrum tear.
Yep. Okay,
that came back negative. Good. And great. Then the one of my SI joint.
Okay, great.
Yes, the PT I'm seeing is part pelvic floor, too,
great.
Because
okay.
I do have a stage 2 prolapse as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
All right.
So perfect.
Well, there you have it.
Are you hypermobile? Are you, you know, kind of hypermobile in your joints?
I wouldn't say no.
Okay. All right. Okay. So I think you're on the right path. It sounds like we've narrowed it down to it as the sacrum. Many women will experience pain in their sacrum or will develop a sacral pathology with childbirth. Mm-hmm. So that's an unfortunate kind of negative side effect of childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing a pelvic floor therapist or somebody who specializes in this is definitely the right path to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're probably in the right space for now, Lori, would you
right.
say?
Yeah, I agree. Those are exactly the things that I wrote down on my paper here.
Oh,
like,
good.
Oh, should she see a pelvic floor therapist? So it's all in that area. It's all so interrelated.
Yes.
So it sounds like you found somebody who has gotten you on the right track. And that brings up a point of, you know, if you see somebody and they have developed this hypothesis about what's going on, and so they have you doing the strengthening, oh, you just need to get stronger and it's not working, then if they are unable to shift gears, then you need to find somebody who is a better fit for what's going on with you. And in Lee's case, the pelvic floor therapist in combination with looking at the SI joint is the right. It's the right strategy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There you go, Lee. Thank you for calling. Sue in Stone Lake. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm calling to thank Jill and Lori. I called in several months ago and was confused because of conflicting information I was getting about having a partial knee replacement. And their comments were so encouraging and so positive, saying, you know, partials have come a long way, and wow, you're being offered a partial, I would go with it. So on March 3rd, I had a partial knee replacement, and I'm finished with physical therapy. I am walking 2 to 4 miles several days a week. I'm walking easily up and down the 70 steps to our lake. I am so happy I did it.
Oh, good.
Awesome. Awesome. Love to hear that.
Yeah, that's great, Sue. Thank you very much.
Well, and I'm sure that her dedication and diligence during her postoperative recovery obviously played a huge role. She had very specific goals she wanted to get back to, shared them with her physical therapist so they could design a tailored program for her. And I'm confident, Sue, that you aren't going to let your exercises fall by the wayside, are you?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to keep doing them, right?
That's great.
And one of the things that you just mentioned, Jill, is having these goals. You know, when we see our patients, we often ask them, what are your goals? And sometimes we get a bit of a blank stare, like they're not sure, or it seems so obvious to them, but it isn't obvious to us. I mean, we know they want to decrease their pain if they're having pain, of course. But what kind of things do you want to get back to? So Sue says, I want to get back to hiking. I want to walk 2 to 4 miles per day. So that gives me a little bit more structure and some boundaries of what I want to do and how I want to tailor my program. Others say, I want to be able to get up and down off the floor to play with my grandkids.
Yeah.
You know, and that's we'll approach that rehab differently than someone who wants to go hike, you know, 4 or 5 miles a day,
you know,
so understanding what the patient's goals are is a really important piece of an effective rehab program.
Sue, thank you so much for calling.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Appreciate your call very much. Dale in Port Wing, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dale.
Hello, Larry. Hello, guests. I was just wondering, I had a hip replacement surgery in the middle of December. And I held it off for a couple years because my occupation is outside, a lot of physical work, and I finally bit the bullet and got it done. Question is our squats a load bearing squat exercise something that you can do after a hip replacement surgery? I had the right one done, and also my orthopedic surgeon had said that high percentage of people who have hip replacement surgery most likely will have their other one done sooner or later if it's showing some kind of, breakdown of that joint. So I guess that's my couple of questions, and I can take it off the air.
Sure. All right. Thanks for calling.
There's no contraindications to squatting. The thing that I would be most conscious of is gradual loading and gradual progression. And I'd start in a very controlled environment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no contraindications. And you want to keep those muscles that you train with squatting very strong,
right.
Your glutes and your quads. So no,
right.
I see nothing wrong with that.
As long as you have good form.
Yes.
You're not squatting 400 pounds.
Correct.
Things like that.
Correct.
So common sense goes a long here.
And I would probably, the other question is how deep should you go in a squat? And I would probably keep it to 90 degrees of knee flexion, not go into a deep squat. Yeah. You don't need to go into a catcher's position.
Right. Unless your job requires you to do that on a regular basis, there's no functional advantage to doing that.
I wonder how often catchers wind up with hip surgery.
I don't know. Our dad was one. I'm telling you, at 80, he could go into a full catcher squat.
Good for strong muscles.
Yeah, he had no hip or knee problems, but boy, he must have had some spinal stenosis. I think he got in that position to relieve some stenosis in his back. That was our working hypothesis.
right. Yeah.
Oh, let's turn to Douglas in Viroqua next. Hi, Douglas.
Hello, yes. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share a story that when you have the right specialists and doctors, they can sometimes really do some wonderful things. Because I'm 66, very active, had severe pain in my left hip that progressively got to the point where I had to use a cane, and I lost 20 pounds. I couldn't sleep, and what happened was they went through all the procedures of the MRI, the x-rays, and the analysis and everything, and they said, wow, I don't know, maybe we should try. It didn't look like it was that progressive of arthritic, and so they put me on a anti-inflammatory, and I was on it for 3 months, and oh my gosh, I can't believe it. It was like a miracle. I'm back to, I don't have any pain. I'm back hiking like I did and didn't have to go through that experience, at least at this point. Thank you.
So do you know what flared up your hip in the first place?
I have no idea. It wasn't an injury. It wasn't that I fell. I have no idea. I mean, other than I hiked pretty aggressively in the driftless area, four to 6 miles a day. I don't know.
Was it a gradual onset or a sudden?
Gradual over 3 to 4 months where the pain just became so, incredible.
So I love the clinical decision making here of looking at imaging, talking to you, and making sure that, we just don't jump to surgery on you. One of the things, Douglas, I would do is consider a couple appointments with a physical therapist, because I know what Lori's thinking in her head right now is why one side, especially if you're in the driftless area and you're doing a lot of hiking, things like that, from a prevention perspective, to make sure that you have good strength on both sides, good mobility, and things like that, so you don't have another one of these gradual exacerbations that puts you out of commission.
Right, because we always want to know, like, if you end up in such pain that you lose 20 pounds and you have to use a cane, like, how did you get there?
Yeah. Right.
You know, in the absence of an acute injury, what were the factors that led to that? And the fact that you can't put your finger on anything concerns me that there's something underlying that's not being addressed. And so, as Jill said, we want to prevent a recurrence of this.
So, see your PT.
Yeah.
Doug, for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Lori Tyne-Brody and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, our guests today as we talk physical therapy issues. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on the show. Larry Mueller here. Tomorrow, by the way, Lake Mills veterinarian Dr. Bill Stork returns to talk about your pet's health. Then we talk to Allison Foch, who is president of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Right now, physical therapy on our minds with Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist at UW, as is Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum. Great to have them with us today. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. I think Paul in Madison, I believe we lost Paul. So let's go to Pat in Evansville. Hi, Pat.
Hello, Larry and guests. I injured my shoulder when I was playing racquetball. I dislocated it when I was 19. And I reached just out of sheer reflex, I reached over and popped it back in and continued playing like an idiot.
Of course you did.
I love it.
So that's what you do when you're young and dumb. But after I gave birth at around 30, then it started to feel like something was drilling into my shoulder. And off and on now, every time I use it, like for raking or for painting or anything with my right arm, it is really sore and my hand goes numb. And I don't think I've ever had it x-rayed.
Yeah, there's many things that could be amiss here with this, Pat. So when you dislocate your shoulder and the humeral head or the ball comes out of the socket joint, you can have a couple things that can happen. You can tear your labrum, which kind of fosters stability or adds stability to the glenohumeral joint. You can tear that on the way out and you put yours back in. There could still be a labral tear there. It doesn't sound like it was out for a prolonged period of time. The other thing you can get is like a little bony indentation on the backside of your shoulder, which is called a Hill-Sachs lesion. and both of those things could add to a little bit of underlying instability in your shoulder, which you may have learned how to kind of compensate for throughout the years. However, as we age and our muscles age and our rotator cuff becomes a little degenerative, its job is to hold the ball in the socket joint. So it would behoove you to probably have somebody look at this just to kind of steady your ship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing that concerns me is the numbness that happens. So if you're getting some instability, you could be getting some pressure on a neurovascular bundle in the area, and that's not a great thing. So, you know, you dislocated, was acute injury, so, you know, I'm wondering, are you still hypermobile or did you stretch out your connective tissues there so you have a lot of movement in there? So some stabilization exercises would be good. But for me, if you're getting sort of numbness or tingling in your arm when it's in certain positions for a while, that needs a closer assessment to see if it is coming from your shoulder and some pressure on a neurovascular bundle as it passes through that area. Or is there something coming from your neck?
Right.
As well.
So Pat, in the numbness and tingling that goes into your hand, is it more in your ring finger and pinky, or is it more a different part of your hand?
Feels like the whole hand.
The whole hand. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then,
you need to get in to see somebody and have that assessed, because that's, you don't want that happening. That's not a good thing, Pat, especially if it's your dominant arm. And I know you're the, oh, let me just put it back and join and keep playing kind of a gal. But it's time to have this looked at so that you can continue to play racquetball and do all the painting and things you do.
It's time to make better choices.
Yes, it's time to make better choices.
We've all been there, done that. Yes. But you know, now it's time to make better choices.
And I chimed in with neck right when you
did. Yes,
you did. I was thinking back to Bill Boisenall.
Oh, yeah.
Could
Bill.
Definitely be coming from your cervical spine.
Yep.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just wanted to offer a nutritional adjunct to the physical therapy and surgeries. About 8 to 10 years ago, every night I was being awakened by my right knee aching, and it wasn't horrible, but it was enough to keep me awake for the rest of the night. And I started taking turmeric, which is a culinary herb, essential culinary herb in Indian cooking.
Yes.
And it's very bitter, so I just really couldn't stand the taste mixing it in food. So I started taking it in tablet form and from Nature's Way. And I started out taking, I think, probably 3 or 4 tablets. And the aching was diminishing, but it was still waking me up. And I just kept increasing the dosage that I was taking until I got to the point where the pain disappeared and it has never reappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I take 10 tablets a day, and to the best of my knowledge, there aren't any counterindications, but people should investigate that before taking it. But it is a natural anti-inflammatory.
That's right. You are correct. It is a natural anti-inflammatory, and I would second your advice
yes.
of speaking to your doctor or your pharmacist before you start taking 10 of them a day. The other piece of it is in the bigger picture, it's an anti-inflammatory. So let's think about our diet. We
right.
talked about mm-hmm. diet earlier, and having the DASH diet or an anti-inflammatory diet where you have lots of green, you know, vegetables, deep red, deep orange vegetables, and the oils that do not contribute to inflammation, and having that as part of your diet would keep you from potentially having to take 10 turmeric tablets
a day. Exactly.
There you go.
But, yeah.
Thank you so much for calling. Yep. Mark and DePere, what's on your mind?
Hi, I'm 67. In January, I had 2 stents put into my heart plus a new aortic valve. They told me 3 to 6 months for complete recovery. I have been going to physical therapy for the last month. Twice, 3 times a week. My major symptom was always shortness of breath, and it used to be pretty acute, but it's gotten better, but now it seems like it's just not getting, I've gotten to a standstill. Now, am I just being impatient, or is it really?
Yeah. You may be impatient.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. is physical therapy, are they doing cardiac rehabilitation specific for your condition, Mark? I guess that'd be my first question.
Yes, it's cardiac rehab.
Perfect.
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That's exactly where you should be.
So if you feel like you feel like you've plateaued or you're regressing?
Yeah, I'm just at a plateau.
All right. So, I mean, the first thing would be to check with your cardiologist
right.
and see if this is the normal trajectory. And is it that you're short of breath? Is that the symptom, or are there other symptoms? When you say you've plateaued in what way?
Well, the shortness of breath.
Okay.
I used to not be able to make up the 14 stairs to the second floor. Now I can, but sometimes I have to pause halfway up or down the stairs.
Okay. So that is a question that goes to your cardiologist,
right?
To make sure that your stents, your valve, everything is working as it should be.
Right.
And then once you're cleared by your cardiologist, then you can talk to your physical therapist and ask about changing up your routine
mm-hmm.
to build in some things that look more like the activities you're having difficulty with.
Right.
So maybe a little bit more interval training. If you're doing things that are steady state, you might want to build in a little bit of interval. But I wouldn't do any of that until I was cleared by my cardiologist first in terms of what the expectations are for the time frame post-op.
I'm very curious. Did you have a mechanical valve, or what kind of aortic valve replacement did you have? And the only reason I'm curious is because mm-hmm. our dad had one.
Had a pig valve.
He had a pig valve.
No, I had a mechanical valve. Yeah. I did see the cardiologist last week, and they told me everything is functioning as it should.
Oh, okay.
All right. Very good.
Well, then I think the next thing would mm-hmm. be to talk to your physical therapist who's doing your cardiac mm-hmm. rehab, and maybe it's time to mix things up a little bit, like mm-hmm. Lori talked about, or do something a little bit different to kind of train your heart differently. Mm-hmm.
Yes, because
good
if you're training
you.
It the same way, just like any muscle, it will respond based upon the load you place on it. So if you're placing the same kind of load on it every day, it's not going to adapt. So you need to change it up
and provide a
novel stress to it.
Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, our guests today. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. And I should mention that we will be doing some other things later on. We'll talk burn wound treatments at 12:30 on the show today with Angela Gibson and Brian Pogue. So looking forward to that as well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. It is another physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, back with us. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison, and Lori, a physical therapist at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lots of emails, lots of callers online, so let's go back to the phones. Bob in Brooklyn will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I had a knee replacement back a year ago in January at Sauk Prairie.
Okay.
And I had excellent results. I had a little swelling. I had my bend of my knee a week or so after it went way farther than it had to go.
Awesome.
But they recommended, and I used this machine that Medicare paid for, and it was a programmed machine that you pedaled, put on a chair and pedaled it. And I used that for a month, and I highly recommend it. I don't know. I don't remember the name of it.
So it's one of those pedalers that sits on the ground, and it's like a little bicycle?
Yes.
Yeah, Yeah, we recommend those often for people. If you don't have a stationary bike at home or something, it is a great tool for lubricating your knee, for getting your knee moving. So, you know, for people who are, you know, sitting at home after their knee replacement and they look at their watch and they say, oh, shoot, it's time to do my exercises. And they do their exercises and then they sit in their chair again. For people who have one of those pedalers to keep your knee moving really helps move some of the waste products from the surgery and things like that out of your knee and remind your knee that it needs to be moving. It needs to be bending. So that's a great tool, and it sounds like you did well with it, Bob.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. John had emailed relating to this. Biking has helped John's knees as they have no ready access to a pool for swimming, and one knee is bone on bone, but John intends to avoid joint replacement. Moving a lot without bearing weight helps a lot.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're getting to here. And so when you are biking, just not putting a ton of resistance through the device or the machine and keeping the resistance a little bit lighter and trying working on higher revolutions per minute is what we would suggest. And exactly like Lori said, it's motion is lotion, and it creates a really nice lubrication and a nice flush. It's interesting. Lori and I do a week-long bike trip almost every year in the with 10,000 of our closest friends, as we like to say. And I believe the average age is like a 57 or 58 year old male. And it's part of it is that's such a biking is such a lifetime sport. It's so good for you. You don't have to have impact, things like that. And it's really good for your joints as long as your bike is set up appropriately.
And your heart and everything.
Everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep. Thanks, Bob. Liz in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I'm calling because I've had shoulder pain from an injury for more recently, probably the last 3 years, and I had an MRI in January, and the biggest finding is that there is a likely chronic tearing of the long head of the bicep tendon, and there's a little bit of blunting appearance and degeneration of the posterior superior labrum, but the joint kept intact. And I just recently, and I've had an injection in the shoulder joint, didn't take away the pain. And I recently tried prolotherapy, which is kind of where they inject with dextrose solution to kind of re-inflame the area. I'm about a month since that, and it was like I re-injured it again, of course. So that's been really difficult. I'm curious what your feelings are about, and I'm also a 54-year-old, very active female that was a personal trainer. So the shoulder has done a lot for me, and I'm hoping that it can do more for me in the future. I love to paddleboard and do all sorts of things, but haven't been able to do it.
Right. So the things that they've done, the injection and the prolotherapy, seem to be intra-articular to deal with the labrum, whereas your pain is probably coming from the long head of your biceps.
100%.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do anything intra-articular in this at all. So those things didn't help you. I would take down your biceps.
Right. Yeah.
So what we're talking about, mm-hmm. Liz, it sounds to me like, yes, they found some things on your MRI, but the question is, are those the pain drivers? And if you did not get relief from an intra-articular corticosteroid mm-hmm. injection, I think you can feel fairly confident that posterior fraying of your labrum is not a driver. It's more or less an incidental finding.
Right.
So my best guess is your driver is the long head of the biceps tendon, which could be attaching to part of your labrum and making it angry. So one of the surgical procedures they do is called a tenodesis, and they literally go in and they cut the long head of your biceps and they move that insertion point down onto your humeral head between kind of the two grooves, your bicipital tuberosity. And so it no longer pulls at your shoulder. It still flexes your elbow and supinates your elbow. And I can tell you anecdotally, people swear by it. Mm-hmm. It's like they have really good outcomes. So I don't know that I do anything intra-articularly with your shoulder.
Exactly. We're on the same page here. That the pain is not coming from inside your joints, so interventions there are not going to help. It's extra-articular. It's outside.
Yep.
Liz, there you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Kurt in Belleville, on to you now. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I injured my knee a few months ago, and I've got a particular condition where I don't have any quads in my right leg from a tumor resection back when I was 15. The problem I'm having now is when I go down steps, when I land on my, quote, good leg, it feels like I'm hyperextending my knee. And I was wondering if there's an exercise that I could do to support that knee joint rather than hopefully not having to have a knee replacement.
Okay. Jill, what are you thinking?
Just to clarify, when you go downstairs and you're stepping with your, we'll call it your uninvolved side, and your uninvolved side goes down on the step, you're saying your leg that's on the top stair is hyperextending? I just want to make sure I got this right.
No. If I step down with the leg that still has quadricep,
yes.
That knee is not being cushioned by the other leg.
Oh, the eccentric control, and that's it. Got it.
So the right leg is lowering you down with your left foot onto the step.
Correct.
Okay. Right.
That makes total sense.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Thank you.
If you don't have good quadriceps on the right, it's not going to control it very well. But what's new now? You had that surgery when you were a teenager. So what is change that now you're hyperextending your left knee when you land?
My daughter bought a condominium and I replaced the floor.
Okay. Again, we talked about good choices and bad choices earlier, Kurt, and so
you
missed that part.
So the
saving grace here is that he mm-hmm. has a mechanism of injury.
Yes.
That makes me feel much, much better mm-hmm. than if he said, I cannot think of anything I did that stirred this pot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would still see a physical therapist mm-hmm. At this point because something like laying down new flooring tips the mm-hmm. scales for Kurt
right.
and takes him out of homeostasis.
Right, right. And the thing that concerns me about your landing in hyperextension is you're going to tear a cruciate.
Right.
And then you'll be in the doghouse on your good knee.
Or
you're going to fall. Yeah.
Yeah,
so I think you should get into PT, have them examine your knees. They may even be able to give you some things to work your hip on your right side
right.
to provide better control
correct.
As you descend the stairs. But if your left knee is getting abused here,
yes.
I worry that
yes.
that something is going to happen to that, and then you're going to have trouble.
Yeah, and you have a very unique case with your
right.
extensive history.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Good luck, Kurt. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Claudia in Sun Prairie next. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was in about a week ago to see the doctor because I was having pain in my right leg and knee. And he said it was I-L-I-O-T-I-B-I-A-L.
Iliotibial.
Yep, iliotibial band syndrome.
Band syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yep.
Is that a muscle or a nerve or... He suggested physical therapy on a roller thing.
Foam roller, yeah.
I don't have pain all the time. I have a great deal of pain going, it's my right leg going upstairs.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your iliotibial band, Claudia, is a band of really, really tight connective tissue, but it attaches to a muscle at the front of your hip called your tensor fascia lata. So down by your knee, it isn't a muscle. It's kind of this thick tissue.
Mm-hmm. Band of tissue.
Band of tissue. That's why it's called an iliotibial band. Typically, people who get irritation of their IT band, and we can just say IT band, and then you'll be really cool, Claudia, because that's what people call it. You don't have to say that whole word. I would be looking at your hip. I would be looking at your hip and your lower extremity chain to see what's different side to side. So many people get IT band syndrome because they have weakness at their hip. So looking at your right hip, comparing side to side, seeing how you're going up and down stairs, see how you're using your quadriceps muscles will be important. And I hear you say you don't have pain all the time. If you don't get this fixed, you will.
Mm-hmm. No.
Right. So. And let me say this about foam rolling. And I'm just going to go out on a limb here to all the PTs. I hate a 6-inch foam roller for the IT band. So it puts you in a remarkably awkward position.
Oh, yeah.
And there's no evidence that foam rolling your IT band does anything except it's excruciatingly painful.
So I think the only benefit to foam rolling your IT band is you gate pain or you change the mechanoreceptors because you can't stretch that tissue. I think we can all agree that we're not stretching tissue, and you will hear people say that.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, I do wonder if people have some trigger points or tightness in their vastus lateralis, which may be getting the point. But I agree with you, Lori. Yeah. It's for a very specific patient population.
Right, and I always tell people, if you really want to do that, get a firm pool noodle because it's the diameter is much smaller, and you'll get the same effect without putting your back in a really awkward position.
And you can cut those up.
Cut those pool noodles up.
And you can go see a physical therapist and go through the things that you need to do to keep this from coming back and getting worse.
Right.
All right. Good luck, Claudia. Thank you. Jordan in Marengo, it's your turn. Hi, Jordan.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for taking my call. I had a partial knee done over 4 years ago up here in Ashland. Great staff. But it was great for a while. And then over the years, the pain has come back in my left knee. I'm about to have the right knee done as a partial in a couple weeks, and the pain, residual pain, 4+ years later in the left knee is just about as bad as the right knee. And my comment, I guess, is it seems like gait and flexibility are kind of shorthand for wellness, I guess, because even in my ongoing workers' comp episode, that's what the workers' comp people are using against me is, oh, your gait is fine, your flexibility is great, you're fine. There's that. And then, I just want to amplify the pre-conditioning thing because I'm in the middle of that now, getting ready. And I'm only 63, but I have been pretty sedentary because my knees are so bad. But, so I'm back up on it and getting going for it. But I'm just wondering, I know you haven't seen me or whatever, but I'm wondering if you have any opinions about the shorthand of gait and flexibility not being the only, guidepost. And then is there anything I can do about it 4.5 years out?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So as Jill started at the very beginning of the show, flexibility is an impairment.
Mm-hmm.
Gait is we call it an activity limitation. So it doesn't speak to anybody's pain. It doesn't speak to anybody's ability to function.
Right.
So can you walk 6 feet? Sure, you can walk 6 feet. Do you have good flexibility? Yes, but that doesn't necessarily translate into being able to use your knee in the kinds of activities that are important. If you're going to use a scale, especially in a case like yours, to measure your progress, I would use what's called the patient-specific functional scale. Mm-hmm. In a PSFS, you pick generally between 3 and 5 activities that are important to you, and you rate your ability to do them from a 0 to 10 scale, and then you do basic math on where you're at, the percentage deficit. Because everybody's different in terms of the activities they want to do. We talked about this. Do you want to hike 5 miles? Do you need to be able to do certain skills for your job? Or do you want to be able to get up and down off the floor to play with your grandkids? So
I have a question. So he had the surgery on the one,
mm-hmm.
and that was 4 years ago, but now that's acting up. Could it be the case that he has changed his gait on the good foot that has now created problems for the one where he had the surgery?
Right. Yeah. So that was the other thought, is that his original knee replacement is being overloaded because he was having
pain on the other side.
So absolutely. That's a fairly common finding that we see, which is one of the decision points in when do you get your joint done, when it's starting to impact the other joints, either in the same kinetic chain or on the other side.
Right.
So it's possible that pain could be lessened after he has this surgery?
Maybe.
It's possible.
It's possible. One of the things that comes to mind for me is he would really benefit from a pool.
Right. So the question going back to the homeostasis thing is, let's say, for example, he stirred the pot on the left as his right knee was going downhill. Can the left knee return to its previous level? Can it re-achieve homeostasis? And we don't know the answer to that. But getting in a pool would mm-hmm. actually give him a better opportunity to see if that left knee could calm down once the right knee's done.
Yeah.
Jordan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Donna in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm 81 years old, and I'm joining a hiking group, and I do a lot of walking.
Good.
But I was wondering, do you have any recommendations for hiking shoes or boots?
So, first of all, good on you.
Good for you.
81 and joining a hiking group. These are life goals.
You made
goals.
My day.
These are life
you made
goals
my day.
For us, honey. Yeah. Sophie, Laura and I just looked at each other and smiled. So, first of all, walking poles would be a very nice addition for you. There's some really mm-hmm. nice retractable ones out there, and I think using some walking or hiking poles might be a good thing to do. I would practice with them a little bit prior to joining your whole group. With regards to shoe wear, you said you've been doing a lot of walking. If you're going to change surfaces, you probably need something that's going to be a little bit more on an uneven terrain. So where are you going to be hiking, Don? Are you going to change kind of the landscape of where you're currently walking to go hiking? Does that change?
Yes. It's in a local park here in
okay.
Eau Claire.
Okay.
So if you have shoes that you're currently wearing for walking and they're working well, I would take those into a reputable store and say, this is the kind of shoe I've been wearing and this works for me. And a good shoe person would look at the we call it the last, the shape of the bottom of the shoe, the structure of the heel cup, the amount of arch, et cetera. They would take a close look at that shoe that works for you and match a hiking shoe or mm-hmm. boot that has those same features.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what I would do. And then you need to break those in.
Yep.
You can walk around your house, walk around the block with those, and break them in gradually before you go on that first hike.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
It does sound like fun. Yeah.
Good luck, Donna. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Peter in Wanakee, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. Hey, I've got some low back pain, maybe sciatica, maybe IT band like you were talking earlier. But for the last couple of years, I've had situations where I'm out walking with the dog and my left leg will start to go numb a little bit. And I also, for my work, I drive a lot. And I've discovered that my hip flexors were super tight. And I don't know if I've just pulled everything out of whack in that low back area. My question is, will a TENS unit help
and fatiguing some of those muscles to get that to relax.
No, it's like
putting a fracture on, or it's like putting a Band-Aid on an open fracture. It'll look better, but it's not getting it to the root of the problem.
Right. Yeah. So the sitting and the hip flexor tightness. So just a word about hip flexors from our sponsors. Your hip flexors go from the front of your hip and they attach to the spine, to the front of your low back. So if you sit all day, whether you're in a chair or a car, your hip flexors will get tight. And when you stand up, they will pull on your low back and they are going to cause pain. So stretching hip flexors is a really key component in preventing and treating back pain. That being said, stretching your hip flexors safely can be difficult because it's a tough muscle group to get at without annoying your back. So there's some really specific ways to do that. So I think seeing a physical therapist for one or two visits to learn how to effectively stretch your hip flexors without annoying your back, and probably doing some strengthening stabilization around your core, hip, pelvis, abdominals would be useful to you before this thing gets out of hand.
Right. More active treatment than a passive device.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for calling, Peter. Appreciate it. And Dennis emailed to congratulate Jill and Lori's father for being a dedicated catcher. Dennis said pitchers get all the glory and they don't do squats like catchers do.
So it's so funny you say that because you will hear, you know, in a 9-inning game or whatever, they may go through 2 or 3 pitchers. The same catcher stays out there. The catcher has to throw the ball as many times as the pitcher.
Yep.
And people forget that. Yeah. So yes. Oh, that's really nice.
Unless the batter hits it. So there might be a few less repetitions. Yeah, right. But for the most part, yes, the catcher throws as many times
as the pitcher.
And they
throw from their knees. And so they can't get their whole body into it.
Yeah.
I was watching catchers this weekend. The Brewers had a game and they stole nine bases during the
They won like 14-1 or something.
They stole 6 bases in one inning.
Wow.
What fun.
I was feeling sorry for the catcher because the pitchers weren't holding the runners very well.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, thank you both very much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sure.
In almost exactly a month from today.
Yep, perfect.
Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist, excuse me, an athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Coming up, we revisit a conversation we had about burn wound treatment with UW-Madison surgeon Angela Gibson and medical physics professor Brian Polg. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, every year about 40,000 Americans are hospitalized with severe burn injuries. And because burn victims require specialized treatment and long periods of recovery, the medical care they need can be very expensive. And today, we're talking about a possible new treatment for burn injuries. Join us, a couple of guests, as a matter of fact. One, Dr. Angela Gibson, a medical director of the UW Health Wound Healing Services in the Department of Surgery at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Gibson is also vice chair of research in the department's Division of Acute Care and Regional General Surgery. Dr. Gibson, welcome. Thanks for joining today.
Thank you for having me.
With us as well, Dr. Brian Pogue, who chairs the Wisconsin Institute for Medical Research Department of Medical Physics. And Dr. Pogue, welcome to you as well. Thank you for joining in.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Have you suffered from severe burns or had a loved one or close relative have that issue? How were your injuries treated? Was the recovery long and difficult? I'm sure it was. Dr. Gibson, maybe first you could describe how challenging it is to treat burn injuries using the current methods that we have.
Yeah, it is pretty challenging in that things haven't changed a whole lot in the last, 50 years, although we've had a lot of advances in how we care for burns. It's been really challenging to translate those to humans. A lot of the studies are done in animals, and they don't always translate to humans. So we're relying on a lot of the things that we have used for many years, pretty simple washing the wounds, taking care of them, getting good pain control, and putting on some pretty simple dressings.
Yeah, and you have something like this, obviously, on the face of it, it's terrible, but there are complications that can come to the fore, Dr. Pogue, with burn wounds. Are there not?
Well, I'll probably let Dr. Gibson answer this one. I'm coming in more from the physics and engineering side.
Okay, Dr. Gibson?
Yeah, so complications with burns can be anywhere from short-term, such as infection, and delayed wound healing, and then long-term scarring that affects functional outcomes. And addition to all of that, it's the traumatic injury itself and the trauma that people have to go through to recover from the injury, the pain that goes along with healing and just, the emotional trauma of having been involved in a traumatic event like a burn.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're very costly to treat, partly because of the time, as you suggest. Skin grafting is attaching healthy skin to an area of severely burned skin. Why might you want an alternative to skin graft surgery, Dr. Gibson?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's actually one of the main reasons why, we're interested in developing advanced therapies to treat burns is that skin graft requires us to take skin from somewhere else on someone's body, on a person's body, because only your own skin can be used to skin graft a burn or a wound. And taking that donor site, as we call it, really is painful. It's basically removing the upper layers of skin and exposing the nerve endings. And then that is another wound that they have to heal in. So if there's any way that we can avoid doing that, that's why we're working at trying to develop new technologies to let people heal their burns in on their own.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Pogue, maybe a research interest of yours is photodynamic therapy. What is that, and how is it currently used?
Sure, yeah. Photodynamic therapy, it's the way to think of it is it's a light-activated chemotherapy, so you can kill or damage tissue with light by giving this injectable or topical agent. And so normally it's used, like, in cancers or precancers to kill them. But what we've been thinking about and looking at in this new research direction is giving sort of a light version of it. If you can think about it, that old adage that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, it's sort of a light. If you give a light version of it, it can actually stimulate the tissue to heal itself a little better.
And the two of you recently received, I think it was a 3-year grant, $600,000 from the Wisconsin Partnership Program to test the effectiveness of photodynamic therapy for burn wound care. Why do you think this might work?
Well, I think from just a real simplistic view, if we can increase the wound healing capacity and there's enough, we change the environment of the wound to enhance that healing. I think there's definitely it's worth trying this in
to try to avoid having to take that donor site. And so we're really excited about the opportunity to potentially do this research with this Wisconsin Partnership Program grant. It was really exciting for us to receive that.
Maybe talk about what that Wisconsin Partnership Grant Program is. I'm sure a lot of people aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, so it's an internal funding through our institution that was created many, many years ago. I think they're having their 20th anniversary this year, where they basically, their mission is to positively impact the health of Wisconsin. And so they solicit for funding opportunities for various, many, many different types of research. And they have a wonderful panel that reviews them. And they include, they actually include outside members, so people who aren't specifically doing the research, but to, from the community to help understand what this impact could have for the community. So it's been a really wonderful program to provide pilot funding for various studies and new avenues of study.
This spring, you presented research on the use of delayed fluorescence on burn wound healing. And you described this as a novel approach, if I'm not mistaken. How will this, or will this new research relate to your work?
So this new research is more focused on a therapeutic, so not so much looking at how we assess the depth of the burn, but in treating the burn, and so in providing a treatment that may enhance the healing. You know, I could see in the future there could be some synergy between the two in understanding the depth of the burn, potentially to determine if this therapy would be helpful.
Yeah. Dr. Pogue?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. So in that work, we discovered that this photodynamic agent preferentially does exist in burn. So it's a naturally occurring molecule called protoporphyrin 9. And so that is a photosensitizer. And so we can use that to activate and deliver photodynamic therapy within burns. And just as Dr. Gibson was saying, you know, if you can stimulate the wound to heal itself a little better, then it reduces the need to do skin grafting. And so that's the gist of our focus is, can we stimulate burns to heal themselves a little bit better, and especially, you know, just burns that may be on the edge of needing a graft or not needing a graft to stimulate themselves.
How big an area do you need to have before, or how small an area before skin grafting comes into play?
It depends more on the depth of the burn. So if the depth of the burn is deep enough that it's removed all the regenerative capacity of the skin and it's bigger than, say, you know, a couple of centimeters wide and it's in a functional area, all of those things make us think that we need to do skin grafting. And so, you know, even small burns that are on the hands or the feet or the face, those, if they're deep enough, they will require skin grafting to avoid really aberrant scarring.
Our guests today, Dr. Angela Gibson and Dr. Brian Pogue, are working on a new research grant, $600,000 grant from the Wisconsin Partnership Program, to test the effectiveness of photodynamic therapy for burn wound care. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with our guests, Dr. Angela Gibson, Dr. Brian Pogue, as we talk with them about their research on burns. And just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Dr. Gibson, to determine whether this PDT is safe for treating burn injuries, you'll be testing the therapy on pigs, as I understand it. Why pigs?
Yeah, so pigs are the animal model that most closely represent human skin. And they're a large enough animal that we can do a lot of different conditions on each animal, because our goal is to do as few animal experiments as possible. But it really is important, as you mentioned, to make sure that this is going to be safe and effective before we think about transitioning to human studies.
Yeah, and I understand that you'll be working with veterinary staff at UW-Madison.
Yeah, we have a wonderful pig core facility that allows us to perform these studies in a very humane manner, and they receive wonderful care at this facility.
Yeah. Dr. Pogue, how important is animal testing in medical research like this?
Yeah, I think, it's essential. It's an essential step. It's not the only step. Of course, we've done a lot of research already in mice, and a lot goes on in terms of planning. But in the end, before you go to human studies, you have to try them in a living system that mimics human skin. And so, just as Dr. Gibson said, I think the swine model is the model that's fundamentally accepted all over as the best surrogate for human skin.
Wow. And if this PDT therapy, so what's the process on this? This is a long process? Well, I guess you've got 3 years of research time to spend on it, but...
So I could just say, the key is we don't know the drug dose level or the light dose level that's appropriate, right? And so that's exactly why we couldn't jump into humans use or study, because, we really need to try different drug dose levels and light dose levels to figure out the sweet spot of where it works the best. Because if you overtreat, you can do harm. And if you undertreat, there's no value. So it's really, we have to find just the right level of drug and light dose that causes this effect, this sort of therapeutic effect that we're looking for.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think I mentioned there's something like 40,000 severe burns in the U.S. every year. How many do we have in Wisconsin, Dr. Gibson?
But I don't have the exact numbers in Wisconsin for all burns, but we admit about 300 to 350 burns to our burn center at the University of Wisconsin. We are the only level one adult and pediatric verified burn center in Wisconsin. And about a third of those are actually pediatric burns. And there's also a burn center in Milwaukee that does adult, and a burn center in Milwaukee and a pediatric surgical center that does pediatric burns in Milwaukee. So there's a good number of patients who do require admission for their burn injury here.
Yeah, and I had been thinking, and Joel, I know our producer today had a question about that too, and Jeff, what are the most common causes of these burns?
Yeah, I'd say the most common that people forget about all the time is putting accelerants on fires. So when people are doing bonfires and just want to get it going a little bit more, they throw gasoline and other, lighter fluid, things like that, just to get it going. And that is absolutely one of the most common ways we see in burn injury. In pediatrics, we see a lot of scald injuries, usually around the year to year and a half, 2 year old, where they're getting up, moving around, pulling things off of the counters, being at their parents' feet while they're cooking and stuff. So just being careful. In the winter, we see fireplace, hands on fireplace for pediatric patients. But really, it's that kind of accelerant on things that I think really catches people by surprise.
Yeah, I. As many times as we see and hear information about it, it's that's not going to happen to me. I'll just throw some gas on that.
Yeah, all the time people say that. They say, I've done this all the time. It's never been a problem. And all it takes is one time.
Somebody else, we got an email here. What's the difference between first, second, and third degree burns?
Yeah, so first-degree burn is like a sunburn. The upper layer of skin, the epidermis, is damaged, but it doesn't go deeper into the dermis. A third-degree burn goes all the way through the dermis to the subcutaneous tissue, and that absolutely requires a surgery to heal in if it's big enough, because there's nothing to heal it in. And then a second degree is this big area or this big group of burns that's anywhere from a superficial second, so it's just kind of getting a little bit into the dermis, all the way down to deep second degree or deep partial thickness burns. And those oftentimes do require surgery because they've really burned through all of the regenerative areas within the skin.
Oh, do sunburns ever get to third degree?
No, not a normal sunburn. Yeah. So sunburns do sometimes become second degree where they start to blister. If you do have blistering sunburn, that is a second degree burn.
Okay. And do they tend to undergo multiple surgeries? Because there's, I'm wondering about children here for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Is treatment for children with burns more complicated?
It is because of trying to minimize pain and suffering. I mean, obviously, you know, we want to minimize that for adults as well as pediatrics, but there's just the margin of error is much smaller with younger kids. And so not only trying to get them in a dressing that we can change less frequently to reduce their pain, but also just the impact that a burn has on the physiology of a pediatric patient is often much more severe.
Dr. Polga, thinking back to the research that you're doing, would this be a possibility for use with young children?
I think ideally we would like that, but I think rarely would you want to start there. We probably start more carefully in adults. Again, Dr. Gibson might correct me there.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, technologies that come out for all of our medical patients start with adults and then making sure that it's safe and appropriate and then testing it on pediatrics.
Boy, I'm thinking it's got to be difficult with burns with kids because they're growing.
Yeah. So the scarring can become much more problematic if they're growing and their skin isn't growing normally with them. And so we try to get them to heal in with at least, as little scarring as possible.
Are there, here's another email, are there any home remedies you recommend for like first degree burns or should people seek professional treatment first or second?
So for first degree burns, you know, cooling, don't ever put ice on burns because ice will cause the blood vessels to constrict and it can deepen the severity of the burn. And so cool water for the pain control. And then if the skin is still intact as it would be with a first degree burn, just using lotion is a good way to treat that. For a second-degree burn, where the skin is actually sloughed off and there's blisters, you know, washing that well, getting all those blisters off, and then treating them with an antimicrobial topical ointment and a nonstick gauze, that, you know, if it's small enough, that can be done at home. But if the pain is too much, such that the person isn't actually washing it well to clean it, then they should seek medical professional help.
Amy and Eau Claire emailed to say they've read about sugar packing wounds and burns to increase the speed of healing. Is there anything to this method?
Not that I know of. I'm unfamiliar with that.
Sugar packing wounds. It doesn't sound like it would work for me. But how did you get interested? Let me turn to Dr. Polk, how'd you get interested and involved in this burn research to begin with?
Well, I got into it through Dr. Gibson, really. my expertise is in photodynamic therapy, which is the mechanisms and the delivery of this light-activated treatment. And again, I'm more of a cancer person, but through discussions with Dr. Gibson, we realized that there's potential for this to activate the tissue. And again, you know, the original part of this, I think, is that, you know, it's a way to kill or harm tissue, but if you give just a very small amount of it, you can actually activate tissue to heal itself. And that, I think that's the key part that we're most excited about.
Yeah. And Dr. Gibson, how did you get this become an interest for you?
So burns became an interest for me. I started my career as a nurse, and my first unit that I started on was the burn unit, and I haven't left since. Became very enthralled with the patient population and the ability to see the wounds healing. And the burn survivors are just amazing people who, you know, go through such traumatic injuries and come out much stronger individuals. So I really love the patient population and I love watching the wounds heal and I love doing research on it.
Yeah, I would think so. I think there's got to be a mental side to this to someone who is, especially if it's a
a burn that is disfigured to any arms or face or something.
Yeah, it's definitely trauma that they both emotionally and physically have to be helped heal through. We have wonderful support systems for our burn survivors, and I encourage, if someone does have an injury that they haven't been seen at our institution but want to get connected with our burn survivors, that they should reach out to our burn center.
Oh, and how would you do that?
They can just look up the burn center on the internet and give us a call, and we will start helping people get connected.
So UW-Madison Burn Center, something like that, into
UW Health Burn Center.
Okay. The research on this is going to go on over the next 3 years. If this proves effective for the treatment of burns, how soon might human trials start?
Well, I think that depends a little bit. I'll ask Dr. Pogue to weigh in on kind of developing the actual tools to do that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. Pogue.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a little unclear at this point, right? But photodynamic therapy is delivered to patients for skin treatments every day for precancerous lesions. So and the drug that we use is approved for human use, and the light delivery systems exist. So that's one of the more exciting things about this, is that if we see that it's working, the potential to translate into a human clinical trial would be seamless, really quite easy.
And what would a trial consist of in like this? Usually you have a control and a treatment in a trial.
Yeah, it just depends on how the study is designed, but oftentimes we can do a control, an intrapatient control. So the patient themselves, we would split their burn wound in half or in parts, and we would treat one part of it and not treat the other. Sometimes we don't need that control necessarily, and so it just depends on how we design the study.
So that's an interesting way to think about it. I hadn't thought about it, treating half a wound in one way and the other half in another way, and then just checking to see which one works the best.
Yeah.
That is very, very interesting. Well, what's your prognosis, Dr. Pogue? Do you think you're going to get this done in 3 years?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm very excited. I think we'll be jumping into it very quickly. And, again, we've been spending a fair bit of time working with mice, but really we've got to get to the real tissue that simulates humans in the pig model to test it out. So we'll give some answers within a year or two, for sure.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you both today. I want to thank you so much. I really thank you so much for this work. I mean, this is really important work. And I hope it leads to a better outcome for the many thousands of people that suffer burns every year. Thank you both very much for your work and for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Gibson, surgeon specializing in the surgical treatment of trauma and burns and surgical care, who are the UW Health Wound Healing Services in the Department of Surgery at UW-Madison. Dr. Brian Pogue is chair of the Wisconsin Institute for Medical Research Department of Medical Physics. Great to have them with us today. Well, I tell you what, it's always a team effort here, and we've got a great team. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.